I'd like to have the opportunity to negotiate, navigate through the agenda in the interest of time. I'd like to put item one on hold for a moment. Item two, approval of the minutes of our meeting for September 20th, 2023. What's the board's pleasure?
Mr. Chair, this is Mark Petrosimo. I'd like to move for the approval of the minutes
So
of
moved.
September 20th.
Is there a second?
This is Kathy, a second.
Second, thank you. Is there a discussion on this motion? In the absence of motion and properly made and second, I'd like to call upon the trustees for their vote by voice vote. Trustee Graves,
Aye.
Trustee Whetstone,
Aye.
Trustee Elliker is not here. Okay, Trustee Petrosimone,
Aye.
Trustee Gormany,
Aye.
Trustee Sagnella is also an aye. I'd like to put item three on hold for a moment, administrative matters. Item four, age annuity retirement, rule of 80. This is again, it's information only. It doesn't require the deliberation or the vote of the trustees unless there's a question, administrative question on item four. If not, I'll move to item five. Conditional member retirement, again, information only, does not require deliberation or vote by the trustees. Any questions on that? If
No.
not, item six, contribution withdrawals, again, information only, unless there's any questions be entertained by the trustees on item six. Let's see, item seven we'll put on hold for a moment. Item eight, death after retirement, information only. And I'd like to call upon the trustees for a moment of silence and observation of the repose of the souls of Betty Woodson, Anthony Montagna, Albert Cosenza, Marcella Longyear, and Dolores Knight. If I can call upon for a moment of silence. Thank you. Rest in peace. Item nine, payment of bills. Board's pleasure on item nine.
This is Kathy Graves, so move.
Second.
Mike Gormany, I'll second.
Thank you. Is there discussion on that motion?
I have a question on First State.
Sure.
Although there's a section in the invoice about what the basis of the fee is, how do you know what is the 37,000? Is it a percent?
You mean what is the formula they use for the billing?
Yeah, that the in the invoice it tells you what the quarterly amount and what the annual amount is. It doesn't, and it tells you the market value. It doesn't tell you how you get to what the annual amount is. Is that just an amount that's stated in a contract, or is it a percent of the market value?
I really don't know. I'm sure it's in the contract, but I'm not aware. I'm looking at the contract right now.
It's a basis point fee.
It's based on, yeah.
Basis point. So it's, 2 basis points, I think it is, or some very
Okay.
minuscule
So, and
amount.
it's a percentage of the market value.
Correct.
Right. It's just they don't say what it is in the invoice. So I assume someone checks the invoice. The invoice just says you owe us $37,000 for the year, and this quarter you owe us $7,900. That's what it says. It doesn't tell you how you get to those two numbers. So I just want to make sure someone's looking at the invoice and making sure it matches up to something.
Well, how difficult would it be to contact these people and ask them, going forward when they submit their bill to us to show the mathematics on it?
Yeah, I could certainly get that done for you very easily.
Right. And in fact, what they do, they have a line item in there and it shows like market value and then percent, it's what the formula would be, but there's no numbers to get to the calculation. I just want to make sure someone's either auditing it and not just accepting, because you could put any amount in there.
Very good. I mean, Susan, you're doing your job as a fiduciary, so don't be apologetic about it. And Derek, I think, is going to talk to these people to let them be a little more clear on what their mathematics are when they come up with a bill, which is a very prudent thing to do.
Yep. They too, just so you know, they too are fiduciaries and trustees on the account, trust officers on the account. So they have a legal liability as well. So, but I will definitely have them articulate that on their bill.
Very good.
Susan, I'll send an email. No.
All right. So a motion was made to pay the bills. I think there was a second. Who seconded that? Or was there a second?
Mike
Gorman. I second
her. Michael, you second. Okay.
Yep.
Is there any further discussion on the agenda, on the motion? If not, a motion been properly made and second. I'd like to call upon the trustees for their preference by voice vote. Trustee Graves?
Aye.
What, Trustee Whetstone?
Aye.
Trustee Elker? I'm sorry. Trustee Petrosimone?
Aye.
Trustee Gormany?
Aye.
Trustee Sagnella is also an aye. Thank you. If we can go on to item 10, old business. Is there any old business that the trustees would like to entertain? If not, item 11, is there any new business that the trustees would like to introduce?
I just had a question. This is Susan Whetstone on the Hooker and Holcomb contract.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered how we're doing that procurement. Are we operating under the city's procurement procedures, or do we have our own procurement procedures? I know certain services don't require bids, they don't require RFPs. So I just wanted someone to say, how are we procuring this? Because it seems like we're just entering into a new contract with them for 4 years.
I think we're going to be discussing that in a moment under item 3.
Oh, sorry, Jerry.
No, that's quite all right, because we're going to be there in 1 second. Right. So again, I think item 11, do we pass that? Do we vote on that? Under new business? We don't have to. Okay, fine. Let's get back to the agenda again. I'm going to put item hold number 1 on hold also again, and we'll go to item 3, and now we'll get on to Hooker and Holcomb, the administrative matter, their contract renewal. Go ahead, Susan.
Hey, Jerry, real quick, though, we actually skipped over item 7. I don't know if you want to go back to that disability.
Oh, well, no, I was going to go back to that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay. So in item 3, and Hooker and Holcomb, we're back to some commentary that Susan was presenting on that. Continue, Susan.
Yeah, I just wondered what procurement procedure we were using to enter into a new 4-year contract.
You mean there wasn't a RFP developed, right?
No, there wasn't. But I know there are certain, under the city procedures, there's certain services you can procure without going through an RFP or competitive bidding process. So I'm not questioning it. I'm just want someone to be able to tell me, here's the basis on which we're doing this contract.
Jack, could you comment on that from a legal standpoint? Or is that something that we'd have to, would be handled by Carolyn?
In the attorney's renewed contract, I know there was not an RFP in that. So Susan may be on track about certain types of services not requiring one. Carolyn could say better. I think what happened with the attorneys is you had a meeting, you talked about services and how they went and the people and so forth, and then voted.
This is Leanna. This item is on the agenda to be voted on. It was on last month's agenda. We didn't go over any, the future fee proposals. So that is what we are presenting to you guys. The drafted agenda that we also shared, Carolyn already worked on an updated drafted agenda in case you guys are going to vote on continuing with Hooker and Holcomb. If you remember back with the Brenner, Salzman and Wallman contract a couple months ago, their contract expired, and you guys chose not to go out for an RFP, but instead to just extend the contract. It's the same situation here with Hooker and Holcomb. If you want to choose to go out for an RFP, that is an option. If otherwise, if you want to just continue with Hooker and Holcomb, then there can just be a vote to continue with Hooker and Holcomb. Their contract does expire at the end of this month, though, the 31st. I believe there's something in there that it can be extended, I want to say, for 90 days. If you don't make a decision. But again, this is the same situation as the Brenner, Salzman, and Wallman, where you can choose to do an RFP or you can just choose to accept it for the next 4 years.
Is that a one-year contract?
Four. It's a four-year contract.
Yeah, the proposal is for another four-year contract.
Okay. And have the rates substantially gone up comparing their new contract to their current contract?
Want to go, David, Mendel, and Rich are on the call. So I did share the fee proposal. They gave two options.
Yeah.
David can go over with you all if that's okay, David.
Yes, thank you, Leanne. I'd love to.
And before you start, David, I just want you to talk a little bit about your merger. You're no longer Hooker and Holcomb. You're now USI Consulting Group.
Yes. Well, let me
also. Okay. Also, as far as voting today, I believe that the attorneys have not yet completed their review. David, is that right? So I don't know that you could vote today, but you could ask any questions, and that's what we're here for.
I think they can vote, but they can vote on continuing with Hooker and Holcomb. Of course, then we would have to draft the, official document. But I think if they choose to continue with Hooker and Holcomb, that can be voted on today.
What is the continuation period of time, like in between contracts? They could stay on right now without a new contract on the basis of how long, 90 days or?
Mm-hmm. That's my understanding of the existing contract, that they can continue for 90 days. And I think we're in that 90-day period already.
Okay.
The 90-day period would start November 1. And to be honest, if you wanted to take your time and really think this process through, I'm sure we'd be flexible and just, extend that 90 days if it was really going to take that long. Because we want to be flexible and just allow you to do your due diligence research and have whatever discussions are needed. So we're not trying to put any pressure on you. We'll still continue these
services. I don't think anybody's recommend. We just want some legal guidance on this. I think that if we were to extend your current contract 90 days and ask legal counsel to come back to the next meeting and give us, their final review of the new contract document. I think that would that stand pretty well with the trustees?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, see if they're comfortable, going without an RFP and just resuming services of Hooker and Holcomb or the name of a new company.
Well, David, did Hooker and Holcomb look at the contract? Because the contract we presented as the draft was actually drafted by Carolyn, which is our attorney. And then I know Hooker and Holcomb was reviewing it.
Yes, we just have a legal department that has to review all the wording changes that Caroline made. But the end result is going to be, yes, we like this contract. We're not trying to change anything. There's just a bunch of changes to language, just slight changes to clarify things on Caroline's part. And our legal department just has to read a bunch of pages and go through it. But we're not expecting them to come back and make any changes to what Caroline put together.
So in the meantime, in the interest of time, we're not ready to go forward with a vote on a new contract. But we can go forward with a vote to continue the current contract with a 90-day extension period.
Yes.
Is there a motion to that effect?
I move that we extend the contract for now USI Consulting Group, previously Hooker and Holcomb, for 90 days to allow us time to review the new contract.
Okay, and would it also be under that review, legal review, would it also be incumbent upon the trustees to determine if you're comfortable without an RFP?
Yeah, I think, Jerry, I would just like Carolyn or counsel to just tell us what provision under either the city's procurement procedures or I couldn't find anything in our bylaws, but just what provision we're basing renewal of this contract on.
That makes sense. Okay, so we'll ask legal counsel to make some commentary on that at the next meeting as part of their legal review of the contract document.
Yes, I'll discuss that with Carolyn.
Okay, so a motion was made. It was a second. I'm trying to remember. Catherine,
no, we need a second.
Susan Whetstone, I'll second, but I'd also like to continue discussion.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
They gave us two, Hooker and Holcomb gave us two proposals, fee proposals. And those I think we should be able to discuss today. After looking at them, I don't know what other people thought. I actually preferred their second proposal, the 3% a year, but either one is fine. If we're going to have Carolyn work on the contract, it would probably be helpful if she knew what fee proposal the board is willing to accept.
Did I hear correctly that these are Carolyn's, the red marks are Carolyn's changes?
Yes.
Okay, so these are Carolyn changes, Susan, and I think next month we'll be able to discuss it with Carolyn.
Right, but there's a second document in there, which is Hooker and Holcomb's fee proposal. And they give us two options.
Correct.
As a board, we need to decide and let Carolyn know which of those options we're choosing.
And that's why I said next month, when we're discussing all these revisions, that we discuss which fee option we prefer with Carolyn. We have 90 days to finalize this.
Okay.
So, we do have David on the call, so he can speak on that, which is why we had him on the call in the first place, to kind of go over that and answer any questions.
Sure. I can provide a quick summary of the current contract, the services that we provide, and what the two options are. Thank you, Leanna. So your current contract, which was in place or is in place from 2019 to 2023, expiring at the end of this month, it's a flat fee contract, meaning all the services that we provide to you, the trustees, and to Leanna's department are covered under one flat fee, currently $75,500 per year. Those services, which there's a long list, but I'll just give you the main ones, calculations, retirement, disability, buyback, break in service, COLA buyout, all of those are covered under the fee, the valuation reports, the GASB disclosures, the annual data updates, reconciliation, and general data analysis, the annual report to employees, the annual COLA updates, the annual benefit statements, portal access for your current employees so they can estimate the retirement pension, and just general help and consulting to Leanna's department. They're all covered under the flat fee of $75,500. Now, for this next potential contract renewal, we're just proposing essentially no change to the services, just a modest and slight increase to our fees. Our fees have remained level. They have not changed since 2019. So we're just proposing a slight increase. The two options that we're giving, and we're giving two options just to be flexible. We want you to pick the option that's best for your budget. But essentially, option one, because fees haven't increased in 4 years, we bump them up 10%. As of November 1, and then they remain flat for 4 years, no further increases. Option two is just start with a 3% increase November 1, and then continue with a 3% increase every year after for the length of the contract. Again, those are the two options, but we're here to answer any questions or have any discussion that you want. And I'll briefly touch on what Trustee Graves was asking. Hooker and Holcomb was acquired / merged into USICG as of May 1. USI Consulting Group is essentially a bigger version of what Hooker and Holcomb was. The same exact services, the same exact type of personnel, the same type of actuaries. We're doing the same things. So it's like being integrated into a larger, but the exact same company as what we are. Now, we, as our internal entity, the 70 people that were Hooker and Holcomb, we are all still members of USICG, and we will be here long term. We were all kept on as part of the merger, and all our clients remain with us. So we are, for all intents and purposes, we are an independently acting unit of USICG. So what that means for me, the people helping you on the ground, there's really no changes for us or for Leanna's department. It's just a new name above our door. But if there's any questions or concerns about that, please just let us know.
So I do have a question going back to Trustee Whetstone's concern on the fees. So the first option is just a flat 10% increase. And then the second option is an incremental increase of 3% every year for 4 years. Doesn't that essentially increase it by 12% over 4 years?
Over time, yes. Option two, the annual fee for year four is greater than the annual fee for option one, but the annual fee for option one is greater than option two for the first 3 years. Right. And what you're highlighting are there's slight pros and cons to each, yeah, I think that answers the question though.
So option two is a higher incremental increase at the end, after the end of the 4 years.
Yes, at the end.
It's 12%.
Yep.
Versus 10%.
Yeah, for that last year.
Yes. The 10%, I may have done the math wrong, but in the calculations that you showed on the sheet, it appeared we were paying more over 4 years on the 10% version than the 3% version. I mean, it was not a lot more, but it was a few thousand dollars more. So in a way, you're paying more up front. So you're paying more over the 4 years, which is the only reason I thought, hey, if we can save a few thousand dollars, I'll go with the 3% a year. Did I read it wrong?
No, that's correct. Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Well, again, there's not going to be a vote on this today. But it's a good thing that we're discussing the options as to how the payments will be made. Is there any further discussion on this before we go to a vote?
So I thought we were voted. Oh, I did put the motion on the table.
Let's back up a minute. The motion at the table right now is not to vote on this thing today. Correct?
I think there a vote to extend the current contract for 90 days.
Right, we're not going to vote on a new contract. We're going to vote on a 90-day extension.
Correct.
Motion has been made. And it was also, did you second that, Susan?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so a motion has been made and second. Is there further discussion on this motion? In the absence of, I'd like to call upon the trustees for their reference by voice vote. Trustee Graves?
Aye.
Trustee Whetstone?
Aye.
Trustee Petrosimone?
Aye.
Trustee Gormany?
Aye.
And Trustee Sagnello is also an aye. And we'll revisit this at the next meeting on a broader scope in terms of the actual contract document and whatever method we're going to use for the payment. Item B, under administrative matters. I'm very concerned about the figure that I'm seeing here that Derek, help me out with this. Are they saying that our fund has lost somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million on these class action lawsuits? For I would think that these are situations that are some skullduggery or chicanery that went on with some of these companies or these investment opportunities. Am I right or wrong?
I'm just looking at which is this? Where is this? Is this the agenda, Jerry? Oh, here it is, BFA. I got it. So a lot of these things are unrealized. And you have to remember a lot of the class actions. So I can't speak at length because I'm not a lawyer, but a lot of times, a lot of these class action suits are investigating potential misdoings in these companies. And a lot of this, you know, loss, potential loss are market losses that are either realized or unrealized. So they're not necessarily directly related to any wrongdoing. It could just be market forces, you know, the equity market selling off, the stock going down.
But they are losses to the fund.
Well, whether or not they're realized or not, Jerry, because let me put it in perspective for you. If, you know, one of our managers, our large cap equity manager, buys a stock at a certain price and that stock goes down in value because the market has gone against it, but they never actually sell the stock, that's not necessarily a loss to the fund. It's down, you know, right? It's down, or conversely, it could be up. So if a stock is down, it's not necessarily a loss. So a realized loss is if they sell it, it's down, and it's sold down on material news that, you know, there was some sort of, you know, wrongdoing within the company, then yes, that's a realized loss directly related to a wrongdoing of someone inside the company or some other force. So that's when typically the attorneys come in and talk to you about, you know, what these cases represent and, you know, what they see as misdoings and, you know, so on and so forth.
Well, then I think that because that 2 million, over 2 million is a big figure. And I understand what you're saying, realize as opposed to not realize. I think that they should let us know what is the actual amount that the fund has suffered. The law firm should let us know that.
Jerry, this is Leanna. So Nancy from BFA sent me the following email. She stated that, again, BFA has been monitoring since the second quarter of 2021. Prior to that, I think you guys had maybe three or four different companies doing the monitoring, but now we, you know, just consolidated it into the BFA. And she did identify, like you said, close to $2 million, like 1.1 was in FIFO and about a little under 1 million was in LIFO in losses. She said those amounts may not be the same as recovery.
What's the difference between
loss? And what she said, BFA calculated the estimate.
Leanna, can you share what you're seeing? Because I'm looking at the agenda. I don't see the BFA. I see a spreadsheet.
Yeah, we did not. It was just an email from her, which I was just going to forward to the trustees. But Carolyn said to have it on the agenda. So, again, I'm not an attorney. I don't know how to explain this information. But I do have the email that can be forwarded to the trustees to review her actual email. She did say these losses are not in settlement yet, so they can't try to gain any of these money back until, you know, something were to begin on these actual losses. She says that does take security cases usually take about 3 years. Since she joined, the fund has recovered $6,600. Those are from prior cases where the fund was involved back to 2014. So these do take time to potentially recover money. It's not like an immediate recovery.
Right. And I'm actually looking at that spreadsheet that was, I think that was in the agenda of past settlements that they grabbed for, I think that represent that $6,600. It doesn't really give much verbiage as to what it was, you know, what the claims were for or what have you, but.
Excuse me, Derek, I think as trustees, as fiduciaries, we're looking at $2 million, that's a big figure. And I understand where you're coming from. It might be realized. I think we have to know. We have to know, trustees, what did our fund, has our fund lost money today because of whatever the reasons are, nefarious reasons that these people are involved in, something that went haywire with these investments. We've done the best that we can to make sure we safeguard the fund and that the investments are done on a prudent basis. Now, if somebody's telling me, one of our legal firms, that, you know, you potentially could have lost $2 million to that fund, that's a big number that we have to know about. And I want that law firm to tell me exactly what did our fund lose? What have we lost because of this action?
Jerry, can you share with me, I think, as trustees, you
have to know that, right?
Can you share with me what you're looking at? Because I'm just looking at a spreadsheet.
Yeah, where do you see 2 million?
Well, there's an email. Let me read it to you for a second, all right? This says, this is from Nancy Kalesa. Since we began monitoring the SIR fund in the second quarter of 2021, we have identified 1.2 parentheses FIFO and 985,000 parentheses LIFO in losses for U.S. once a settlement is reached and a plan of allocation is in place. Most settlement funds are distributed on a pro rata basis to authorized. The fund has not recouped any of the above losses yet because the cases are still in litigation. Since second quarter of 2021, BFA, the law firm, has filed claims on behalf of the SURF fund and has recovered $6,618. Don't spend it all in one place for the fund. BFA has filed numerous, I can't read the whole thing, in touch with Northern Trust to confirm that claims have been. It sounds to me that this is money that we've lost.
So, yeah. So again, I would also take pause in, you know, I know when Mario used to sit on the board, he had choice words for these types of lawsuits. Ultimately, you know, when you invest in equities, that's whether you're an everyday investor or a fund like yours, when you invest in equities, and sometimes you make money, sometimes you lose money, if they happen to coincide with a law firm that has found that there is some sort of misdoing within the company, they try to attribute those losses to that misdoing. And that's when they get the class action together. And at the end of the day, to your point, you've reclaimed $6,600. You know, the law firms are the ones that make the big money. I mean, they take the big chunk of the class recovery, and then they, you know, siphon out the pro rata shares to all the shareholders that are in the class. So usually there's not a lot of recovery to, you know, to the class. I mean, it's just,
I think a judge can grant them up to 25% in legal fees.
Yes, that's correct.
So my question is this, the $2 million she's speaking of, does that represent just our fund or all the funds that held that stock at the time, if it's a class action? That could just be sure. The total.
I think that was SURF's loss, Kathy, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that was, you know, I don't have the email. She didn't break down, you know, what the securities were, what managers, because you have to remember, you know, when you invest, a lot of those losses, if you look at our reports, like we're down this month and this quarter we're down. So there's going to be realized losses this quarter. That's just, you know, the market goes up, it goes down. But again, if some of those losses are attributed to skullduggery, then yes, then it's a problem. And that's where these lawyers get involved. So that's, I think they try to correlate losses to, you know, corporate misdoings. So, you know, again, is it coincidental loss? So their job is to try to attribute those losses specifically to something that has done, you know, corporate executives or, you know, whatever, bad accounting practices or what, you know, misrepresentation, whatever their modes are.
Well, I'm just saying that as trustees, I mean, if somebody were to stop us on the street and say, hey, I understand that, you know, our fund might have lost $2 million. And we're going to trust you to say, yeah, well, I'm not sure. You know, we have to have a better handle on that for the constituents of the fund. And maybe she should come to the next meeting with a more comprehensive report, because all I care about is, did this fund lose money? And what's the reason we lost it?
Well, we also, like Derek said, you know, when the market fluctuates, we lose money. So I don't know. I guess I would want to know what that $2 million represents. Is it multiple companies? Is it one company? I think I'd like to know more details.
I think it's multiple companies, Kathy. Let her explain it to us. She's the attorney.
Right. Because we're not looking at the email that you're looking at. We're just looking at a spreadsheet.
Right,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, Leanna, can you ask her if she can... Even through Zoom, if she could attend the next meeting?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. I'll do that.
Trustees want a better handle, and we want to know what the fund has actually lost and what the reasons were that these losses were incurred. But we're more concerned about the situations where there might have been some naughty people out there that handle our money.
Again, I don't think it was people that handle your money per se. I think it's just the stocks themselves, the companies, you know. So if a money manager buys a company because they reported good earnings per share, you know, and it looks like, oh, this is a good investment for the fund, the money manager's doing their job and being prudent investor on behalf of SURF Fund, and then someone within that company misrepresented those earnings, that's a direct correlation, and the stock goes down, that's a direct correlation of a loss. So it's the public-traded companies that within the companies that they're investigating. It's not the money managers or anybody that's directly involved with, you know, your fund. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, the more you watch this on television, you see these investment people that are going to jail and that have taken millions and millions of dollars from their investments that they were entrusted with. So I don't trust any of them. I don't trust any of these people.
Well, Jerry, in this case, what Derek is saying, you know, a money manager, it is not the money manager's fault.
Well, I don't care whose fault it was.
Wait a minute. Let me finish. These are issues that come up within the company, like the Heinz company. I'm just looking at the spreadsheet.
Right.
The Heinz company, Wells Fargo. These are things that happen within the company where the money manager has no control over. None whatsoever. It's like me investing in Key Bank and Key Bank does something. Well, it's not my fault that the senior people in Key Bank does something nefarious. I mean,
right, but if the fund
out
lost,
of my control.
If the fund lost the money, I don't care who did it. I want to know what happened. That's
well, knowing what happened and trying to blame the investment managers, two different things. So it's not the person that's managing the money or the company that's managing the money. It's what happened within the company.
Well, I'd like to see more of this because I don't trust any of these people that are handling this money, to be honest with you. That's the reality I have in my mind. I don't think anybody is beyond anything. And if the money manager did exactly what they're supposed to do and another party involved in the chain did something wrong, fine. But I want to know who did it. I mean, as trustees, we have to know somebody had our money, and if it's not worth what it was when we gave it to them, if there's a legitimate reason, fine. If there's something that went on that was a wrongdoing, I want to know that also.
But that's what
am I wrong as a trustee and a fiduciary to say that I have something in front of me here that says potentially the fund could have lost $2 million and just walk away from that and say, well, too bad, you know, too bad, so sad. I don't think that's what we're here for as trustees. And tell me if I'm wrong.
Yes, you're wrong. So what I'm saying to you is you have to separate the two. You can't blame the investment manager on what happens in a company.
I don't think I'm doing that, Kathy.
That's all I'm saying.
Somebody, if our fund lost money, I don't care if it was the investment manager or somebody else in that chain. I don't care. I want to know what happened. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's a different question. So, yes, to have
these. That's what I've been saying since we started discussing this topic today. That's exactly the point I've been making. I want to know
what happened. Just want to know what happened.
I beg your pardon?
You just want to know what happened within the company.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. And I think as trustees, we got to get those answers. Mark, am I wrong? Susan?
We have to know who misled who. Is it at the company level? Is it an individual within the company? I agree.
Because that's what this legal firm is doing. They're monitoring the companies.
Well, I want them to come and I want them to explain this to us. Because yeah, I know that at one point there was one case that there was some purposeful misreporting of information that brought the price of the stock up. And as a result, there was a loss of the investment. But that's the type of thing I want to know about.
I think, Jerry, your suggestion about having the representative of the firm come in, and if she can take the information that was in the email she sent you, if she's identified $2 million of losses, she ought to be able to walk us through
exactly
where those losses are, why she thinks there's opportunities for recovery, and then what those potential recovery amounts would be. And that would tell us, I mean, if she's identified these different losses, then she's got a basis for saying why it's $2 million and not $10 million. And she could walk us through it. I think the spreadsheet tries to do that, but I couldn't follow the spreadsheet at all. It was really just too complicated. So I think if she could kind of narrow it down to what she has in that email, and just walk us through that cohort of the $2 million, it would be a lot more understandable to me as a trustee.
Or Liana, can you contact
on the spreadsheet? It doesn't.
I beg your pardon. Go ahead, Kathy.
On the spreadsheet, it doesn't tell us whether these are losses or gains. It's just amounts identified, settlement amounts identified, and estimated recovery. It doesn't say whether it's a loss or a gain.
I don't think there's any gains in that report. Do you, Derek?
There's recovery.
There's not negative numbers at all.
There's recoveries. That's it.
Yeah, I don't even see the settlement amount. It's just the settlement amounts. Yeah, it doesn't say. Yeah.
It doesn't tell the story at all. So no. What you're seeing is in that email, we're not seeing that.
Yeah, so Nancy's done that in the past, Jerry. You remember, I mean, you all have.
I just did that.
Yeah, so I'm sure she'll come in and say, you know, talk about a couple of the cases and, you know, what the big.
We'll have her at the next meeting.
I think she'll answer a lot of your questions.
All right. So we're not going to belabor, but she'll be present at the next meeting. She can review these figures with us. And at that point in time, as trustees, we've done our due diligence, you know. Okay. Can we go on to item C? Discussion for RFP for medical consultant. Liana, you want to handle that?
Yeah. Hi, this is Liana. I have this on the agenda because the current contract that we're in with EL Occupational expires, I want to say it's May. So I wanted to bring to your attention if you guys wanted to go up for an RFP.
You know, Liana, I remember the last time that we reviewed medical consultant, it was very difficult to my recollection to get people that wanted to respond to an RFP for a medical consultant. There weren't that many out there that really wanted to respond. And I think that Yale, pretty much almost on a sole source, was continued. I could be wrong now. I don't know. But there might be more.
No, I think you're 100% correct. My problem is, unlike Hooker and Holcomb, which we love doing business with, Yale is the biggest headache ever to deal with.
Yeah, I understand. I remember that. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. I am not opposed to RFP. I endorse that for a medical consultant. I'm just saying that I remember the last time it wasn't that easy to get a competitive process because there weren't that many. There weren't any other medical consultants that wanted to come in and get involved in the RFP process. Now that could be 100% different. Now you may have a myriad of companies that come in and want to do that, which is fine with me. I have no vested interest in keeping Yale if there's somebody else that can do a better job administratively for you.
Yeah, I that was my concern too, because you're right. I think you guys went out in 20, I think you did all of them at the same time. So like the actuary, the medical consultant. And,
well, yeah.
Yeah, and I think you're right that Yale was the only one. This was in 2017 or 2018. Yep. So I've been crossing my fingers hoping we get some other bids, only because it's literally like me and my staff is employed by them because I'm constantly doing their job. Like we have medical reports that sit sometimes for like 9 months at a time.
Yeah, I hear you.
Where's the medical report for this person?
That's competitive and is going to do a good job. You got my blessings all the way.
Well, let's just go out for RFP and see what's out there.
Yeah. Let's shake the bushes. So is there a time frame as to how we're going to do this with an RFP?
I think Mike's still on, but I would assume it would kind of be similar to how we did. I think it would probably be like maybe, was it 3 or 4 months? I think PNF just went out for an RFP last year. And it was about the same time frame. We started in the fall and a decision was made in like early spring.
I'm just wondering, Liana, if we could make an inquiry to some of the municipal pension plans in the area, and try to determine what medical consultants they use, just to get a frame of reference, without making a lot of work for you.
Yeah, we can try to do that as well. Mike, do you have, would it be like a similar time frame if we did do an RFP, like 3 or 4 months or so, do you think?
I mean, a medical consultant RFP is not as comprehensive as when we did attorney, like an attorney and things like that. I would say probably like, depending on the time frame and when we put it out, I think we could be done within like 2 months to have responses back. It's just going to depend on how fast us as trustees can review and award the respondents. But we can certainly get started on an RFP if that's the board's pleasure.
All right, so that's a game plan.
Yeah, again, their contract doesn't expire till May. So if you wanted to put it off, I did just want to put it on your guys' radar only because, I mean, they might be nice people over there, but it's a headache in our office trying to constantly be like, where's it? And I get the same response, oh, we're working on it. And then I don't hear anything for 3 weeks and I'm reaching out again. Where's this medical report? And the people are calling us saying, I was seen 2 months ago. Why am I not on the agenda?
So well, Yana, then we got to get another consultant. We have to get another medical consultant. We have to. It behooves us to do whatever we have to do, because there's got to be a quicker turnaround time on these things.
Yeah, I agree. And right, we've so talked to them like
we. Mike, you're talking about maybe a 2 to 3 month period for floating an RFP.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Item. Let's see. We've exhausted item three. Now we have to go to that medical item seven, disability retirement. This is a re-examination, a third re-examination. As we've indicated before, if employees retire on a disability, work-related, they are required within the first 5 years of retirement to go to our, quote, our medical consultant and to be examined three times in the next 5 years to determine if the debilitating condition continues and if they are to be considered under a disability retirement. After 5 years, there's no more requirement to be re-examined again. So this particular individual, Toni Asenza, is in her third re-examination. I believe she was in the cafeteria. There's a medical report, and it's up to the trustees to determine if they think, in fact, that debilitating condition still exists, which renders her incapable of working in that in the particular job that she had at the time.
This is Kathy. I move that we accept the medical reexamination.
So, Kathy.
Yeah, rep. Pardon me.
Is there a second?
Mr. Chair, this is Mark Petrosmall, and I second that motion.
Thank you. Is there a discussion on this motion? In the absence of a motion made and properly seconded, I'd like to call upon the trustees to express their preference by voice vote. Trustee Graves?
Aye.
Trustee Whetstone?
Aye.
Trustee Petrosimone?
Aye.
Trustee Gormany?
Aye.
And Trustee Sagnola is also an aye. If we can return to, I believe it's item one now, for our medical, our financial consultants to give a report.
I would love to be the medical. You could call me doctor if you'd like. Leanna, is it okay if I share my screen just to navigate a little more easily?
Yes, go right ahead.
All right, let me see here what we have. Let me cancel that. Give me 1 second, sorry. Okay. All right. So this is the, let me just move my little box out of the way here. So this is my, the fund through September. So this is third quarter. As I mentioned earlier, it's a rough quarter. And I'll talk a bit about So what I'm going to talk about in the markets today is, you know, kind of what has happened over the past quarter, and then I'll give some guidance moving forward. So I'll go through this a little bit more on the quick side, unless there's something that, you know, people want to talk about. So, you know, 1 month, we're down, the fund was down 3.36%. For the 3 months of the quarter, it's down 3.08. Fiscal year to date is down 3.08. Obviously, it's just that one quarter. Year to date, 3.9. Rolling 1 year, still a good number, 11.4. So for a longer term, the fund is still doing pretty well, but we've had some short-term turbulence, and I'll talk at length about what's going on in the markets and why that is. You can see large cap growth has underperformed. So a lot of this has to do with what's going on with the Federal Reserve, with interest rates. As always, every time I talk, I feel like I'm talking about the Federal Reserve. But ultimately, growth stocks have underperformed for the quarter. But if you go out longer term, they've outperformed for the 1 year. But you know, you can see growth. Our growth allocation is only about 8.4%. We overweighted value some time ago in anticipation of these rate hikes and this rate sensitive stocks on the growth side. So large cap growth is down 6.28. Large cap value is down 4.29. So growth did underperform value for the third quarter. Moving on, our Cook and Bieler are the managers. Notable mention. Short term, a little underperforming short term, but long term they've outperformed here. You see year to date they're up 3.5 versus 3.6 versus 1.8. 1 year 17.7 versus 14.4, and since inception of 12.25 versus 9.4. So that's looking good for that active manager, Cook and Bieler. American Century is a newer manager, some slight underperformance, but nothing to be overly concerned with yet. Mid-cap was down 4.78, in line with large-cap value, but mid-caps have struggled right along for some time, and so is small-cap. The nice thing about our small-cap is our small-cap managers outperformed. If you look at the benchmarks, Fuller and Thaler has done a nice job. Ironically, we pulled $6 million from to pay benefits from small cap back in July. So we reduced this position from, you know, over 20 million to 16 million. So we did save a lot on this loss. This 1 month, 5.56 is down on a much lower number than it was if we had let this money stay. So we basically trimmed the position actively. And that turned out to be a good thing, good timing. As you can see, the fund is, the Fuller and Thaler is down 5.56. Look out though, 6 months, fiscal year to date and 1 year, they're more than the 1 year number. They've more than doubled their benchmark. And since inception, they've doubled their benchmark. So Fuller and Thaler has done a fantastic job in the small cap space. I'll talk about small and mid cap equities when I start talking about the markets. WCM, again, some underperformance. We had them in. We have not had them on watch from my recollection, but we did have them in to talk about their underperformance. And they did. They were a very, very good manager. Look, long term, they're still up 8.5 versus 3.5. But they are trailing, and they're trailing for a multitude of reasons. I think I'm going to have them come in and speak at either the next meeting or the meeting after that, just to kind of give a recap of what's going on. They were in last calendar year, but it was end of year. I think it might have even been December or November. So they were in fairly recently, but I would like to have them come back and talk about what's going on. Alkyon, you can see, is down short term, but long term, their numbers are still good. Year to date, they're up 15.5 versus 9.6. 1 year, some underperformance, but you know, they're a very growth oriented, technology focused fund, global, and we'll talk more about that moving forward in the equity, and when I talk about the equity markets. Fixed income, the fixed income world. So we have one typo here, Federated on the bottom of the page. There are our newer domestic bond manager that should be up here under domestic fixed income, because you see there, Barclays Ag. But both our domestic bond managers have outperformed, both Federated and Dolan McNeary. Again, so our total fixed income is light. Domestic fixed income, we're at 11.25%. That's a very small allocation. Total fixed income is under 17%. And that's been intentional just because of, obviously, interest rate movements. We're starting to see some potential opportunity in the fixed income. So, you know, when we start to get the influx from the ARC, we'll talk. We'll have, obviously, have active discussions with all of you about where we're going to deploy money, but we'll probably look to beef up our fixed income component of the portfolio because I think there's going to be some good opportunities there when the Fed ultimately does stop the rate hikes. And we'll talk a bit about that in a moment. But anyway, Dolan McNary outperformed on the downside. You could see their benchmark was down 2.5 for the month. They're up 1.17. 300 basis points of outperformance here on the 3 months of the quarter. They were down 0.36 versus 3.25, positive for the 6 months. And you go out to, you know, 1 year, they're up 5% versus a paltry, you know, less than 1% return for their benchmark. So that's very, very strong outperformance from a bond manager. We love to see that. LM Capital is a fairly new manager. They've been around since last summer. International bonds, conservative bond manager. If you remember their presentation, they were very, very conservative, and that's helped them obviously on their performance. They've outperformed both in the short term, in line on the long term. You can see 1 year up 7.22 versus 8.61. Still solid numbers. So, you know, the 1 year number we're getting from our bond managers, 5 and 7%, 7.25%, that's pretty good return for a long term manager coming from the fixed income space. So we're happy with ultimately the allocation there. Balyasny was our hedge fund. They actually liquidated. So they liquidated last month. So we have that money in cash. We're going to use it to pay benefits. It's actually timely. So we do not have any hedge funds at the moment. And then private equity and real estate, we're still waiting for their third quarter valuations coming in. I'd imagine on the October meeting, the October report, you'll see some of these valuations. So there's no real performance there. We're sitting about $9 million in cash. The benefit payments per month here are a little over $3 million a month. So we like to keep a couple months worth of cash on hand. And that's roughly what we have. So that said, I don't know if there's any specific questions, but I want to just move on a little bit about some of the long-term numbers and allocations. I could pause if there are any questions about any performance numbers before I move on. No. Okay. So this just shows graphically, we always want to bench the fund to the investment policy statement to make sure we are close to our targets. If we're not at our target, we want to make sure we're at our target range.
I didn't hear you.
We just want to make sure when our target range is here. And you can see within everything is green with the exception of the hedge fund. Like I just said, that just liquidated. So we don't have any hedge product at the moment. Not overly enthusiastic about any hedge fund out there at the moment, but we will keep our eyes peeled if there is an opportunity there. But we'd rather see the allocations within some of the private investments at that point, but and or fixed income. But again, just to keep in line, we are all very close to our target ranges. It's just another graphic depiction of where we are. You can see we're a little overweight on cash, as I mentioned earlier. That's to pay benefit payments. This just shows graphically the pie chart of breakdown. Fund is roughly 55.5% equity, which is a fairly conservative allocation, 16.5% fixed income. Again, this was representative of the 6.8 hedge, private equity 10.4, just under 6 in real estate, and a little over 5 on cash. And this just shows the target allocations from where we are and where we are. So just a nice graphic chart to see. Not much else to talk about within that, unless there's some other questions. If not, I want to move forward and talk about, you know, again, this is the third quarter market update from our firm. I'll just burn through some slides pretty quickly, and then I'll talk briefly about what we see, you know, moving forward and what's something that's a little bit more timely. So this is a little bit backwards looking, but basically what we're talking about is the, you know, equity consolidation, which we just saw in the report. We saw all of our equity managers were down. Equities were down quite a bit over the quarter. And the reason being is that the Federal Reserve came out with a hawkish comment that is, you know, we're going to pause on rate hikes. You know, the last rate hike was a pause, but it's going to be higher for longer. So ultimately, the market was a little bit more jubilant about, okay, there's going to be, prior to this last Fed meeting, that, you know, rates were going to stop going up and inflation was coming down and the world was good. You know, the Fed just came out and said, you know what, there's going to be, we're going to have probably future rate hikes. Inflation's still peaking a little bit. It's not as good as we once thought. So that's that put a strong pressure on the equity markets. And this is what's interesting too. If you look at the S&P 500, the 10 tech stocks in the S&P 500 represented 100% of the returns from year to date. So if you have any diversity in your equity, large cap equity portfolio, you're down, you're not up as much as the S&P, and that's just because of the tech stocks. So that's really a signal to what's going on in the markets. And this just talks about the equity and how it's consolidated because of what I just mentioned, the Fed's hawkish opinion. And you can see within these trading lines here, the market did bounce at this support level. So we call this dotted line here support, and this dotted line up here is resistance. And typically, what happens when markets are in trends, we look at trend lines. As long as they, the market kind of bottoms and stays within the floor and does not penetrate, it's ultimately an okay sign. The market is expected to be volatile. It's expected to go up and down. But as long as the support holds, which it has, things are going to be okay. I'm going to skip down to page five. So this just shows the growth. What I just mentioned, all the growth came from the 10 stocks. One thing that I want to look at though is, large cap has outperformed, but small cap and mid cap has underperformed. So we're going to start to look at some of those areas as potential opportunities. Not yet, though, but just from a pure valuation standpoint, small and mid-cap stocks are starting to look a little better. Dividends paying stocks are out of favor, which is interesting. That's the large cap value, which we talked about. They're out of favor. Dividend paying stocks that are less than 1%. Anything that's over 1% has been in favor. If you look at stocks that pay a dividend greater than 1%, they were down 5.2 versus 10% on the S&P, and a stock, a growth like a tech stock that doesn't pay any dividends is down 15.3. So that's pretty strong outperformance on the downside with high dividend paying stocks. So that's what I think Cook and Bieler has done so well in the outperformance. Scrolling down. So some of the headline risk. So we look at, okay, this is what the quarter did, and what are some of the potential risks moving forward? And there are quite a few. And now, obviously, if you looked at the TV today, there's even more potential risk. I'll talk about that momentarily. But elevated oil prices, the 10-year yield rising, high yield CDS spread. So what that looks at, it's like a surrogate for the equity markets is our high yield bonds. And when you see CDS spreads widening, that's a potential headwind. Personal debt, the auto strikes, one dimensional market, meaning the really concentration on where stocks are coming from. There's a lot of potential headwinds to the equity market. So we anticipate a volatile market moving forward in the light of recessionary pressures in 2024. There was a lot of conjecture of whether the recession was going to be 2023 or 2024, end of 23 into 24. A lot of that has been pushed out now because we've had some pretty good earnings growth on some stocks. So there is definitely recessionary pressures. The talking heads think it's going to be a shallow recession, but nonetheless, recession is potentially in the future for 2024. Moving forward, going down to jobs, inflation. We talk about inflation all the time. Basically, we need to, the Fed is doing all this to battle inflation and make sure that valuations are in line. I'm going to go back to page, where was I? Page 10. Oh, no, 16. I'm sorry. Getting you guys dizzy. So this is just kind of consensus earnings for, what our firm thinks for 2023, and then the outlook for 2024, depending if it's a strong recession, a mild recession, or above trend economic growth. The consensus is a mild recession, below trend economic growth, still some earnings per share growth of $220 to $230. So that's not a doomsday scenario in the recession. You could kind of see right here, earnings per share expectations for 2024 shows some growth from, you know, 2022 and 2023. There was not a lot of growth, and you could see that through the equity markets, and you could see the muted equity returns or negative equity returns. 2024 and 2025 are looking a little more rosy from an earnings perspective. I just want to talk briefly about some economic conditions and call it a day from here. Ultimately, we're targeting a lot of different things in the economy. So the Fed is looking at how can we slow the economy without a complete halt. And you know, credit conditions are still pretty good, even though there's some deterioration in credit, but it's still pretty good, even though there's some hikes in rates. This is the one chart that I've shown in the past, or variations of this chart, that almost with certainty, when the yield curve inverts, and what an inverted yield curve is right here. When the short end of the curve is higher than the long end of the curve, that's considered an inverted yield curve. The curve is typically supposed to be, you know, lower rates for short term and higher rates for long term. That's a normalized yield curve. When the yield curves are inverted, and inverted this much, we're 100 basis points inverted, that's a telltale sign for a recession. And this kind of shows you every single time, these red lines over here are when yield curves invert, and the gray bars are recessionary times. So you can see almost with certainty every single time there's a yield curve inversion, there's a recession. There's no real deep. I mean, you can see how deeply inverted this yield curve is. It's definitively, it's almost 100 basis points or 1% inverted. And so, you know, the recession to follow is almost, nothing is guaranteed, but it's highly likely that that's going to happen. The Fed is targeting a 2% inflation rate. We're right around 3.4, 3.5 as of most recent. The CPI number came out in September, and it was high. It was high, a little bit higher than expected. It was 0.4 versus 0.3 for the quarter. Year over year, it was 3.7 versus 3.6. So it's come down a bit from 3.8 to 3.7, but we're still a ways away from 2%. So that targets the Fed to keep stimulating or keep hiking rates to cool that that down. And this just shows market sell-offs. I just want to show this chart because, you know, when we see, I don't know why it's blurry, I've given a minute here. Typically what this chart shows is intra-year, when there's sell-offs in the market since back to 1980, the red dots show intra-year sell-offs and how much they're down. The blue bars are where they actually finished for the year. You know, obviously 2022 was a rough year, but 2023, to be determined, the intra-year sell-off was 9.2. But it would not be unlikely for a Santa Claus rally at the end of the year to make the market go higher. And this graph just shows long term. Obviously, there's secular bulls and secular bear markets and consolidation. We're still early on in a secular bull market, so the overall trend is upward, but obviously with some ups and downs in between. So that said, I don't know if there's any questions there, but I just want to talk something that's a little bit more timely. I won't spend a lot of time here. It's just kind of a lot to go over for the quarter, but just want to kind of show some of this. This just highlights. So this is more timely. This was written last week, and you can see from, you know, the quarter report, which I just showed, was the September 30. So September 30 to October 11th, that was last Thursday. You can see the market has turned around, and we've had some good returns in the equity market. So barring any unforeseen circumstances, your October report should look a heck of a lot better than your September report. But again, technology leads the way. That's the theme. Higher for longer from the Fed policy outlook. So it did put pressure on equities, but there's been a nice bounce on equities. CPI number came in a little bit higher than expected, but you know, that's okay. Moderate wage growth is good for the Fed because basically That is one of the inflationary pressures. When you see wage growth expanding exponentially or much higher, that puts inflationary pressure, and that would signal a more hawkish Fed. But you can see here, wage growth is moderating on the way down. So though it's bad for the consumer, it's better for inflationary pressure. Skip down here to page four. So now this just shows graphically, this chart shows, the end of the quarter, which I was talking about was, end of September, which is right here, we were bottoming. You can see a nice little bounce here on the equity market. So we were oversold on the bounce from the technical support. Now we have some upside momentum, a little bit of tailwind. The market does need to rebuild. Again, we need to see a wider breadth of stocks making gains. We're in earnings season now. Some banks are reporting today. So we'd like to see some good earnings come through from the market. This chart just shows the bond yields. Again, we don't need to, really harp on this, but you can see it just shows when the bond yields on the 10-year went up, that little orange or pinkish square here, bond yields went straight up, equity markets went straight down. So as rising bond yields start to wane or even level off, that's very, very good for stocks. And ultimately, when the recession does come, you'd probably see some relief from the Fed in a way of a rate cutting cycle. So I'll talk about that momentarily, what that means for the portfolio. One last chart I want to talk about here is CDS spreads. So basically, high yield CDS spreads did not break out. So that basically is a component or a measure of risk in the equity markets. High yield bonds are a proxy for stocks. And you can see that there was not a spike in CDS spreads. So that says that, so the bond market is typically smarter than the stock market. And it doesn't look like there's any inherent major risk to equities moving forward. Now that said, it a lot of things can happen from here. Whether it's, I just want to unshare the screen here. I don't know how to do this. Sorry, bear with me. I'm just playing with this. So getting back to the portfolio and equities, and what does that mean for the portfolio? So I mentioned earlier in the presentation that when the money comes in for the ARC, I know it comes in pieces. Last year we saw some money come in at the end of October. I don't know if Mike could weigh in on that, but ultimately we're going to look at deploying the money prudently. We're going to look to take some active bets in fixed income with our fixed income managers eventually, because we see, once the Fed does relieve the rate hikes, when they start going into even normalized rates and potentially even cutting rates, that'll be a nice tailwind for the fixed income markets. We might right size growth to value. And then small and mid cap stocks are undervalued. So we have some tactical opportunities in the market. We expect, the end of the year, fourth quarter is typically historically always presented a rally. They call it a Santa Claus rally. I'll actually, if I want to share my screen one more time, I could actually show you a chart on that. Santa Claus rally. Page, I think it's 16. Just something to look forward to is, the end of year. So they call this the Santa Claus rally. So we're here in this consolidation phase. It's very, very typical. Read this chart. Since the 1960s, the end of the year has been seasonally strong. Choppiness may continue in the near term. We see seasonality as a nice tailwind. So, Q4, it's potentially a good opportunity to add some money to stocks. So again, as the ARC money comes in, we'd look to add money to stocks and get a little bit of this Q4 tailwind. So we ultimately expect the equity markets to finish strong for the year. We think the bond market is going to kind of be in a little bit of a malaise, but ultimately the worst is behind us, we think, in the bond market. So we felt as much pain. Our active managers, bond managers, have definitely done a good job to protect this fund. So all in all, there's some good tactical opportunities. We're awaiting the cash. We're kind of trying to just wait as much as we can to liquidate any money to out of our investments to pay benefits. So, you know, if I may just kind of get some guidance, is Mike still on the call, on guidance as to when any of that money can be deployed so we could get an idea. Do we lose Mike?
Hey, Derek. No, I'm actually on my way into work, but I'm here. Yeah, we're looking at possibly deploying some cash by the end of next week. I'm working with the city's treasury office on both SURF and PNF and looking at possibly 50% of the gate act payment, which for the SURF fund would be between $10 and $15 million that we're looking at. So, okay. You know, I'll certainly keep you abreast. But I actually emailed Maria Tamaro in our treasury office this morning as we were on the call.
Okay. So that gives us some good guidance. Thanks, Mike. So, you know, as those monies come in, so I don't know. I know we meet quarterly, but if you guys wouldn't mind, if I could come in next month as well, just to kind of talk about, you know, deploying some of that capital tactically, I think it would make sense. So if you wouldn't mind seeing me next month, I would love to be here.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Go right ahead, Mark.
Percent of probability of a mild recession is strong. I mean, what are the factors that we have to, you know, just like look at that could turn a mild recession projection into a more severe recession projection? Is it housing? Is it is the S&P the guiding factor?
No, actually, so economics and finance are very different. I mean, they work in tandem at times. But from an economic standpoint, what's going to drive the depth of the recession is, you know, mostly is led by the consumer. You know, we're a consumer-led economy. And if, you know, wage growth continues to go down, if unemployment is a big thing. So, if, you know, as these companies start to feel a pinch, because consumers aren't spending as much,
right,
there'll be layoffs. You know, so unemployment is a big factor. Wage growth is a big factor. Money supply is a big factor. So typically what has happened, and I've seen it most recent economic instances, the Federal Reserve has been very reactive to pretty much you think about COVID, the amount of stimulus that was injected into the economy during COVID was never seen before. I mean, even prior to that, it was double the amount of stimulus injected in the economy during COVID that it was during the financial crisis. And if you think about the severity of the financial crisis, our country was literally at the brink of a complete financial calamity. And I think they injected about $800 billion of stimulus into the economy over, you know, I'd say 6 months, I think it took. Whereas during COVID, they injected $1.4 trillion or $1.2 trillion within a matter of like 90 days. Or not even, I think like 60 days. So to your point, Mark, if, you know, obviously inflation, rates, unemployment. So the depth of the recession comes, you know, how quickly and how deep is the GDP loss? So recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP, right?
Right.
And how deep that is very dependent upon the consumer and how bad the consumer, how much pain is felt by the consumer. But I think in most recent history, every recession has been fairly shallow due to reactive bullets from the Federal Reserve. And, you know, the Fed has choked off historically. Rates have risen historically, have never gone from zero to, you know, where they are today in 1 year ever. The amount of rate increases and the pace at which those rate increases happened, that was very, very tough to swallow in the markets. But what the benefit of that is when the recession does hit, there are only a few quivers that the Federal Reserve can activate. And one of them is rate cuts. So when rates are at zero, you can't cut rates, right? You're already at zero. So our rates are up in the over 5%. Now we have several abilities to cut rates and to stimulate the economy. So you have the quantitative easing, they can inject liquidity into the market again, and they could cut rates from a moderately high starting point. So if we do get into a recession that is looking to be deeper than expected, there are levers that can be pulled to help get us out of it quicker.
So does the amount of consumer debt have a very is a huge contributing factor? Like you're talking about this Christmas, I forgot what you called it, the seasonal splurge.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm just assuming that everybody's just going to break out their credit cards and do whatever they have to do, increase in personal debt.
Yeah.
Of everyone in the nation.
Right. It's already at a historic high.
Historic high, yeah. It's only going to get higher as we go through the year. That would affect our stocks.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I mean, so now you start to look at from a to that point, Mark. You know, consumer discretionary stocks. So now you look at like from a sector standpoint. Well, what sectors are going to outperform? You know, no matter what, I don't care how bad the economy is, people need to buy toilet paper and they need to buy milk and they need to buy, you know, the necessary, call them staples, consumer staples. Mm-hmm. Those sectors have underperformed up until recently. And there's some conjecture out there from, you know, the market gurus, and they're starting to say, well, we need to see, you know, consumer staples start to outperform. And that's kind of a telltale sign. Those are defensive stocks. There are groups of stocks that are defensive stocks that typically are, you know, the large cap value names. So we are overweight large cap value for those reasons. The growth of your stocks, are people going to go out necessarily and buy a new iPhone? Maybe, maybe not. Are people going to go and take the vacations? The discretionary spending, to your point, Mark, will probably feel it the most. So you have to be more judicious on where you allocate money in the equity markets during these times. But nonetheless, if you think about what has rallied thus far, it's been those tech stocks.
Right.
What has not rallied, so where we'll probably see the tailwind, is the broadening of that equity run. And like I said, the more leveling of those discretionary or staple names that have not done well. And then going into the winter, you also have the energy. You know, people have home heating oil. So the oil companies and, you know, the energy companies, those sorts of things, electric companies, utilities have underperformed drastically. So there's a lot of areas of the markets that have underperformed that we see should have a nice tailwind going into Q4. So it's just to be selective, I guess, is the theme.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions of our financial consultants? Very good presentation.
Thank you all.
Is that a wrap? Is there any other commentary? If not, can I ask for a motion to adjourn?
This is Kathy, so moved.
Is there a second to the motion?
Mark, you're on mute.
Mark
Petra Simone, I'll second it.
Okay, is there discussion on the motion? Usually isn't. In the absence of, can I have a voice vote for the adjournment? Trustee Graves?
Aye.
Trustee Whetstone?
Aye.
Trustee Petra Simone?
Aye.
Trustee Elliker? I'm sorry. I'm getting old. Trustee Mike Gormany? Where's Mike?
He's muted.
We have a quorum. Trustee Sagnola is a yes. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We'll see you next month.
See you guys.
Can I ask you questions?
Bye-bye. Thank you, Jerry.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Jerry.
Thank you.